Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello, good evening and welcome to this week's Mall Over Podcast. The only rugby podcast gives you news, views and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter, we are at Mall Over Podcast, Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook, and you can find all of our podcasts on anchor.co.uk as well as Apple Podcasts, the Google Store and some other podcast type places. This week I am joined by everyone's favourite farm vet, especially the housewives, Phil Elkins. Welcome.
Thank you, Russ.
No problem. The nicest man in Cornish Rugby podcasting, wearing a British Lions pullover. What's a snazzy pullover, Ben?
Took out a small 5-year mortgage to buy it.
Is that your mother's money coming in?
You've also heard there the Lensman. Welcome, Lensman.
Now then.
And special guest. Now, for those of you that follow our Twitter, which I hope is probably nearly all of you that are listening to this, this week, Phil has mentioned that it is the 5-year anniversary that we very first got together to release a podcast. This is pre-Lensman. So much like the Sugar Babes, we have reunited, and I'm delighted to welcome the original host, the original creator, the technical brains behind the original Mall Over podcast, Perry Hughes. Welcome back, Perry, for the first time.
Hello, guys.
God knows how long.
It really was a tinpot operation back then, wasn't it?
Mate, I remember being sat, we sat round your laptop in your living room whilst we banished your missus to the back room.
In our small one-bed flat.
I was going to say, it wasn't even Perry's living room, it was Louise's living room.
True. And then we moved from there to sitting around a mobile phone in Phil's front room. And, oh, wow, those were the memories, those were the days.
George's kitchen table.
George's, yeah, Jane plying us.
Didn't invite George on, did we?
That's true.
How on brand for us, by the way, is it that we started a rugby podcast 3 weeks before the season was finishing?
Well, if I remember rightly, our second episode was the Championship playoff final going on in the background.
Yeah. I mean, we winning Chiefs and winning Twitter was one of the first ones that we created, if I remember rightly,
yes.
On SoundCloud.
Yes, I remember that.
It was just unbelievable. Five years ago. And what a journey. And here we are on Skype recording from different locations with actual microphones and headsets and mediocre editing and all sorts of stuff. But if I was to ask Ben, if I was to ask you what your have you got any outstanding memories of the last 5 years?
Well, in terms of what we've actually done, I think the two trips we had to London were probably the highlights, really. One to the Canterbury event and one to the Premiership final.
Yeah, I got to say, for me, the Premiership final to get the media access and accreditation for the Premiership final was absolutely unbelievable. And that atmosphere is probably one of the best I've ever witnessed.
That door's been firmly shut on the media access because, well, apparently a podcast doesn't count as media.
Let's not count our chickens, Phil. I've been in touch with the powers that be.
Oh,
and we might have some avenues open for the future. Douglas, you were obviously a later arrival into the podcast arena, slipping in through the back door after Perry left it ajar. And yeah, have you got any outstanding or overriding memories since we
just
started?
Just tasting you on a weekly basis, basically.
I mean,
that's the only reason I still turn up.
So, I mean, we've explained this lots over the years. Doug and I were in the RAF together, and we hadn't really kept in contact too much, and we probably hadn't seen each other for about 3 or 4 years previous to the podcast starting. And then after, out of the blue, I get a message about the podcast that I'm promoting, and hey, Tubbs, I want in on that. And then ever since, it's just been a constant peppering of barrage of abuse, but it's what makes it fun. So thank you.
If it wasn't so easy, I wouldn't do it.
That's true. What, to podcast or to abuse me?
Both.
Ah, nice. But yeah, here we are, 5 years later. We're still going. We're still loosely talking about rugby and referees and punching lions and setting ourselves on fire. But more about that a little bit later on. But first, let's talk about some Premiership rugby. Let's start. We'll fly around the Premiership from the weekend first. Doug, you were at Wasps on Saturday. Anything particular of note to chat about there?
It's difficult to watch it in as much detail when your arsehole sucked to the seat where you're so tense trying to direct it and not nause it up too badly.
I mean, how was that? I mean, you've done that a few times now.
Yeah, I definitely do that.
What's it like being in the director's chair when you've got the TMO talking to you and you're sort of almost being directed? Are you the director being directed by the TMO as well?
It's quite. I mean, if you want me to give you
I think it'd be interesting for people that don't really know how it works.
So, obviously, you're in control of everything. So you've got your eight match cameras, the TMO, vision engineers controlling the color levels and exposure of the cameras, VT operators on VT machines, graphics operator, sound, the lot. For the majority of the game, you've got the commentators in your ear, VT every time something happens, offering you shots from different replay machines. Then you've got graphics operators who might be offering you some, like, a little stats box to put in the corner of the frame. You've got the TMO talking to you. So you can, at any one time, like in a big moment, so for example, the red card, which was, I don't like that being a red card. I thought that was
harsh,
a very harsh red card. But at that moment, you have the referee talking to the TMO, who then is in your ear. We need to check that. So you're communicating with the VT ops, who are saying, right, we've got it on this machine and this machine and this angle. Then you've got the graphics operator, because you need to stand by the graphic to say who it is and their yellow card. Then you've got the commentators talking about it, and they might be referencing the other player. So then you're directing the cameras to give you your shots. Honestly, I don't think I can do it justice, the amount of sort of mental processing you have to go through to filter out the relevant information and give it to the right person and still cut a show that doesn't look bad. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so you cut everything yourself. So you have eight buttons, one per camera, and then you have four replay machines. So you have a bank of you might have seen the picture I put up of the mixing desk. It has all eight cameras that are in front of you. So you're watching eight cameras. Obviously you have your camera one, camera two, which is your main cut. Not only are you processing that, but you're then having to press the right button unconsciously, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of has to be like a
reaction.
Yeah. Obviously, depending on which end, you have two corner cameras, so you tend to sit with your right hand is your corner cameras, and you move that as a pair, depending on where they are. Then you lift one up. You have to preview it. So honestly, I can't do it. You can't do it justice. The only way you could really do it justice is to record the output, and then while you're sitting there, you try and cut the same cameras that I'm cutting, just with on a keyboard with like buttons 1 to 8.
It sounds mentally stressful.
So just you know, I've rambled on a bit, but to get to a replay, for example, I'll be, so something will happen, bang, you're on camera two, you'll go, right, what's the information I need to give? I need to give who's in that collision, who's in that incident, where is it relevant, what angle am I going to go to next, which replay machine am I going to, does the TMO need anything? If the TMO needs anything, are they communicating with the ref? Because if they're communicating with the ref, I need to show the ref. So which camera's got the ref? And you're doing all this while it's all going on. You've got the commentator in your ear as well. Then just the process to get from a camera to a replay, you have to preview a replay machine. So you have to, there's two banks of buttons. You've got your eight cameras, which cut live. Then beneath that, you've got another bank of buttons, which cut preview. So you can see what's going on next. To get to a replay, you have to cut. So for example, you go from camera two to cut to camera three, standby VTX. You put your VTX on preview, wipe roll. That's queuing the VT op. You then press the wipe button to get to the replay. You then mix to the next replay. All the while you're doing this, you're talking to the VT op, listening to the TMO. Then you've got to queue up where you're going to come out to. So you'll be coming out to camera three. So you'll preview camera three, wipe to camera three. Right, which angle do you want next? Okay, we'll go to that one. So VT, it's mental.
That's literally my dream
mental.
Job.
And as for someone that's only done a few games, you are literally, the first 10 minutes you sit there, you have no idea what's going on. The first game I did, I didn't even realise it was half time. A ball went into touch and the referee blew for full time. I was like, oh, that's full time, isn't it? We haven't done man of the match or anything like that because I was just so caught up in it. So that's, you know, a brief insight into it. But, you know, and if anyone's still awake, Wasps also played a game of rugby.
what's interesting is, I bet you can't, from a camera position, you've got your focus as the camera, and you know if the play's at the other end of the pitch, mm-hmm. you can't switch off to a certain extent, but you can sort of switch off until you get used to knowing where your action zones are and all that sort of stuff. But
yeah,
like, which means you can spend a little bit more time looking and taking in the game to a certain mm-hmm. extent, as opposed to when you're directed, you can't take in any of the game because you're spending so much time.
I mean, doing, I'm sure else. I'm getting to the point now where the game's slowing down somewhat. So with the directs, I'm kind of feeling a bit more in control. Whereas previously you're sort of hanging on and trying to keep up. And I'm getting to the point now where I'm in control. When you watch the real experienced people like Daniel Hudson, who did the World Cup final, or there's a guy who's Reese Edwards, who's out in America, and he's basically trained the Americans in how to present and shoot rugby. When you're watching those guys, you know, they'll be sitting having a chat to the TMO during the game because they're so in control and they've done it so much. It's like any job, the more you do it, the more comfortable you are. And like for me as a camera operator, when I'm operating a camera, it's almost like the game's on 1/3 speed. Doesn't feel fast because you're under control. You know?
It makes sense. And it was so, you know, when you watch it as a viewer, it just seems effortless. And you wouldn't, as a layman, that wouldn't even see any mistakes, wouldn't notice any mistakes. It would just happen, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You mentioned quite a bit about the TMO there. And we've spoken it about a little bit. Perry, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on TMO intervention in general and what, like, we're seeing a lot more. Like Bristol, the Bristol game on Monday night was nigh on 2 hours long. Yes, there were 8 tries, like, disallowed and lots of stuff going on, but so many TMO interventions, almost uncalled for, just getting involved.
It's getting a bit much, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, where do you see it? Touch judges, TMOs? Should we just let the referee get on with the game? And then a
I think it has to. I think towards the end of that, the Bristol game, it was almost pointless, wasn't it? Some of the decisions that with the TMO was getting involved in, it had no reflection on the game. And it, as you say, it went on for, what was it, 2 hours?
Yeah.
That game, which is ridiculous. But it's been happening for years. It seems to be getting worse. And even the calls that they're making because of it are getting worse and more shocking. And it is almost killing the game. I don't want to say in terms of VAR or anything like that in football, but it is slowing down the game a lot. And it's taken away from the refs, I think. I think like Luke Pearce is quite good at it. He tries to avoid, it seems to me anyway, he seems to avoid going that far with TMOs and trying to take it upon himself. But sometimes they have to, because that's how they're governed. But it is getting silly. It's nearly every decision, almost nearly every try you see, has anything happened? And it's taking away from the game and slowing down the flow of it.
I mean, I'm
always getting TMO at that Bristol game.
Was it Rowan Kitt? Wasn't it CMK and Rowan Kitt?
Because Rowan Kitt's a full-time TMO, right? He doesn't actually officiate anymore.
Yeah, correct.
So I have a theory on this. So we had Claire, can't remember what her surname was, but she was brilliant. She didn't interfere with on-field decisions. She only got involved when she was asked to get involved and was very quick with the decisions. Whereas I feel like some of them get involved where they don't need to get involved. And then when they get involved, their process isn't slick enough. So it's almost like, you know, what you want is a TMO that goes, right, you want me to look at this. And they need to know the layout in the truck well enough, like Claire did on Saturday, where she goes, the angle I want is VTX, and then I want VTY. Cue it up. Let me see it. I've seen it. Nothing to worry about. And then she was on to tempo, nothing to see there, move on. That's all you want. You don't need this discourse between, oh, do you think this might have happened? They need to deal in black and white.
Yeah.
Does part of that come down to, I know Perry just said Wayne Barnes, does part of it come down to ego as well? In terms of, and don't get me wrong, I think Wayne Barnes is by far and away one of the best referees in the world. But he does kind of likes to use his mouth quite a lot and get involved. And is it that they want to be part of it? They're there and they want to be involved and they want to be part of it. And they think their opinion is kind of needed. And ultimately the answer is it needs to come down to the RFU to give guidance in terms of how TMO should be used. And they are being used too much. But there's a, like Rowan Kitt, he's forever going, oh, I think we should have a look at that. And 3/4 of the time, he could have had a look at it and gone, you know what, that's a rugby incident, let's move on. Who was the TMO last night?
Sean Davey.
Sean Davey, yeah. So he pulled up for, was it on Lonsdale? It was a clear out by, I want to say, Creevy.
Yeah,
no,
it was Creevy on Lonsdale, yeah.
And yet Creevy's arm was on Lonsdale's shoulder and he drove him backwards, drove him off the ball. But TMO could have had a look at that and gone, yeah, that's a rugby incident, let's move on. But he chose to stop the game, break it down, have a look at it, and it just ruins the continuity for everybody. The only reason you should be having a minute break at any point during a rugby match is because a fat prop's taking a knee to try and have a bit of a breather.
I think the intention is to get all of these decisions made in live play, but there seems to be whether or not it's a training issue or just a personality thing in that people aren't decisive enough. There seems to be an issue in the speed in which certain people do things. And also, you know, that incident with Creevy last night, we all were looking for the neck roll, but yeah, what went completely under the radar during all that was the fact that Monga actually knocked the ball on the floor.
Yeah.
And it led directly to a try. So if you're having a TMO and you choose to stop the game to check a breakdown, then check the breakdown.
Don't just
go for the highlight, you know, sending off. That was a try that was directly from a clear knock on, but it wasn't looked at because
it's almost like that.
Looking for was a neck roll.
A Genge thing, wasn't it? Because Genge got binned on Saturday, but that was, there was a bit of reversal. I can't remember who got binned before him, but then he was brought back on because there was a knockdown on prior.
Is it Cole?
No, Cole got binned.
It was a Quinns
and then
player.
A Quinns player got, was it Earl Perry? I think it was Earl.
Yes, it
for
was
a deliberate
Earl,
knock on.
Yes.
And then they went back to the clear out, and then Luke Pearce literally apologised to Genge for the yellow card, and he used the phrase "that was a good clear out" because it wasn't he aimed at the guy's head or anything. He just, as he sort of made a good clear out, he kind of bounced into the defender's head, and they just didn't want to send him into the bin, but the protocols left them with no choice.
And this is the problem with protocols. I mean, you look at Mike Brown getting a 6-week ban. He's got a six weeks ban, and in the write up from the report from the citing commissioner, it was acknowledged that it was unintentional. Now, if it was unintentional, why are you banning a bloke?
Yeah, I think a lot of these
leaves you no choice because. Yeah. You touch somebody's head with your boot, therefore you must be banned. It's like, yeah, but it was literally, we are all admitting here that it was an accident. Mm. And it's this, you know, there are a lot of legal minds that are quite high up in the RFU and in rugby in general. And they seem to be able to write these, you know, that it's no coincidence that they're laws, not rules. But a lot of them aren't really fit for a game that has 30 moving parts at any one time. You know?
I'd like to have seen Barnes and Pearce have that discussion as well as the TMO, and then just go, you know what, no card. And if then the RFU or Premiership Rugby or the citing commissioner wants to take it up after the game, then leave it to them. But I think that in that position, like you say, Ben, they didn't want to bin him. They tried every sort of angle and conversation and prolong it to try and convince themselves that they had a way out of it, but they didn't think that they could. So
my understanding is that if the refs looked at something and spotted it and made a decision on it, that the citing commissioner can't then go any further with it. He's kind of, the on-field refs made the decision and that's it, and it moves on. And the problem is the RFU have got this quasi-legal structure where they're trying to deal with something like a proper court. But ultimately, the entire legal structure is based on the fact that things get tested in a court. Laws may appear black and white, but they're not. They're about how they're interpreted in a court. And yet the RFU are trying to kind of emulate that, but only by looking at things in exactly a black and white framework. And it's becoming somewhat ridiculous when you've got referees apologising to players for sin-binning them. But irrelevant of what Ellis Genge did, if there's a yellow card foul, surely you should go to the bin for it. It doesn't matter that there was foul play beforehand.
Yeah, he should have gone to the bin, but they don't get the penalty.
Yeah.
Because it was potentially a massive turnaround, because it took Tigers down to 13 and it That's kept right, Quinns at 15. But actually, it, because Quinns played the yellow card period so badly, it just wound Genge up. So he came on and scored a try pretty much straight away. So it didn't actually do Quinns a lot of good. But
he had a blinder of a game, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I mean, let's, before we start actually talking about actual rugby, one last thing with the sort of refereeing and TMO is I noticed in that game, they really focused on technicalities. And it was a really good game of rugby, but they kind of prevented an excellent game breaking out. And it was, they were really focusing on the offside line and kicks and blocking lines and things like that. And I wonder, I know that if you're enforcing the offside line and a kick chase, you're trying to open up space. But if they're offside constantly, you're just going to break the game up even more with more and more penalties. And I wonder, it makes it less watch.
You shouldn't, though. None of those guys on the pitch are incapable of going, you know what, this ref's really hot on offside from a kick, so I'm going to start a step further back.
Yeah, but I think what they're looking for is they're happy to sacrifice the flow of a game to get 30-second clips that they can clip up on YouTube.
Yeah, but you've mentioned
that quite a few times.
But my point is, if the ref's going to ping for offside, and we've said it about Itoje in England games, if the ref's going to ping and be ultra harsh on offside, the captain just needs to have a word and go, just take a step back. Just don't compete quite so hard on that. Take a step back and we'll have to deal with it because that's the way the ref's going to play it. And it's easy to say when you're playing at whatever level Hornets play at now, level 10, level 15, whatever it is, because each ref is completely different and half of them can only see out of one eye and the other half are deaf. So, like, you've got to work out how to play the ref pretty quickly and you've got to respond to that. But I'm amazed that professional rugby players cannot respond to how a ref referees a game.
Look, I think we've all been in games where you are convinced you're not offside.
I'm never offside.
But, like, also, I've filmed hundreds of games where offside penalties are given, and you can see that those players are clearly not offside. It's such a subjective law that to time for a referee to see or a touch judge to see the exact moment a ball is picked up and the exact moment a player crosses the offside line, it's a guess a lot of the time. And if some players are really, really good at getting off the line, then they're going to get pinged. And I think a lot of the time on those goal line stands, those players aren't offside. They just react quicker.
Yeah, they're reacting quicker than the ref thinks that they can react.
And 9 times out of 10, they might be offside, but the team that have got the ball are pre-latching anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
It's the Linford Christie Atlanta Olympics all over again.
But yeah, that's the overarching thing. I often say, if you
think it's a shit law.
I think
a demonstrably bad law, because the amount of games where teams get down to the 5 meter line and they'll do three phases, then it's offside, and then you've got to go through the whole thing of tap and go offside again. Right, how many of these have we got to do before? Like, Saracens were masters at it. They seem to be able to play the offside game to just the very point of a yellow card being given, and then they'd win a turnover. They did it so many times, and they got away with it. But it's a crap law. It needs to go. I don't know what the alternative is, but I just think it's a crap law.
Talking of crap laws, I'm not going to go for Courtney. I wanted to talk briefly about scrum penalties and how much bullshit, like penalties at scrums are, I think, one of the biggest reasons why we've got so much stop start and so many other leading on penalties in the game at the moment. Teams that are on top in a scrum could be on top for all manner of reasons. It could be because they're better, but it could be for a number of other reasons. the sooner they realise to make a scrum infringement, a free kick, it will stop the game being broken up so much. And I think that if you can, the referees most of the time are guessing anyway.
Flip side to that, I get that, Russ, in terms of you then don't go for a scrum penalty. But the flip side of that is it almost encourages people to, if you know you're under the cosh a bit, to deliberately drop it because you're only giving away a free kick.
Yeah. So I'm all right with that. I just don't think, because you could have a prop could slip. A prop, and it happens every game, multiple times a game. A prop slips and gets a penalty given against him. So and then all of a sudden, or a scrum's going backwards, and it's only the prop that it's only either side prop that ever gets yellow carded for the scrum going backwards. Why is that? It's not the prop's fault. Could be the tight head locking behind him.
The what?
Tight head.
That was a joke. I knew that would get a rise out of someone.
One of the things I think. Having seen a couple of sort of old school games recently where there was no crouch bind set, you know, or a hit or anything like that, loads less scrum penalties.
You're 100%
just bind,
right.
Just it's, bind up and go,
it's
man.
It's the speed at which it happens.
The opportunity.
It's far too slow. It's the speed at which it happens. You want to get, as soon as you've got 16 people there, you go crouch, engage, ball in, done. And if you also stop, Who was refereeing in the Exeter game? I can't remember.
Ridley.
Ridley. But there was...
He's desperate to be Wayne Barnes, by the way.
He is, yeah.
He is. But there was, and he's absolute fucking toilet as well.
But there was an Exeter scrum where they clearly dominated and then both front rows went down. Ball's at Simmons' feet. And he's like, well, just crack on. Get on with it. The ball's there. Stop pissing about. And that's what the refs need to do. Is as long as it leaves that line down the middle... If you're dominant, you've got the ball at your feet, play on. Just get the ball out.
Yeah. Before we end up spending half an hour talking about referees and TMOs and other bits and pieces, is there anything more that anybody wants to talk about on referees before we move this shit on into something a little bit different? And then we'll get back to some rugby matches in a minute. Right, good. So, Patrick Jackson asks... Or what Maulover moment over the years made you laugh the most and which are you most proud of? Doug.
Just repeat the question. Sorry, I was just...
Do you have a Maulover moment over the years that made you laugh the most?
Crikey. Probably when you first told your flaming petrol can story.
Firegate.
Just the fact that you you yeeted it into the street, setting your foot on fire.
I think that would, if you ask most of our listeners what their memories are, I did ask a few people. There was one that was a recent, you know, punching of a lion by Phil, but most have said it was around the Firegate. Ben, do you have anything else that you remember that was funny?
I mean, the Firegate story was definitely the funniest, and partially, I'm sure, because I wasn't on the podcast. But the actual highlight of it is just Doug under his breath, just giggling and just going, 24 pence a litre. Well, at £1.24, I guess. But yeah. The sex whistle, obviously, that was a highlight. I tip my hat to Perry for putting Brad Barrett in every single dream team he ever picked.
Yeah. I mean, those
also
were the days.
Get a Lions call up.
Those were the days. Our fantasy 15s. Do you remember the fantasy 15 of people we wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when we all got blocked by Stephen Jones, wasn't it?
Probably. I mean. Yeah. I'm not going to use that as a badge of honour because we are part of a, you know, 90% of Twitter that's been blocked by Stephen Jones. And talking to Stephen Jones, now I'm not going to force anybody to answer this question.
Do I not get a favourite?
Sorry, moment? Phil. Go on. What's your favourite? Well,
other than Barbecue Gate, which it clearly is. But we did a live recording round at yours, Russ. And put it out on YouTube, I think it was. Or was it Facebook
Live?
No,
it was Big Hit Rugby. Do you remember when Big Hit, we got involved with Big Hit
Yes,
Rugby?
Yeah, yeah. And halfway through, all of a sudden, up pops a little comment that as it drifts towards the top that just says, Fat Dan Cole.
I mean, those days, like those Big Hit Rugby days, and Ruck to a certain extent, but when we used to go live on Big Hit, we were getting like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people watching that video. It is utterly mental that people were watching us in my front room, the three of us, like wired up with the weirdest microphone set up, and Doug on an iPad.
Doug on a telly.
Like Holly at a Red Door. Doing interviews with Matt Jess and Chris Cracknell, and they are actually on the TV screen behind us on my living room telly. Literally an absolute shit show, but all good fun nonetheless. All good fun. One of my favourites, I have to say, was our long-awaited TV show ideas. Burgers. Rhinox Wine Racks, obviously.
Rhinox Wine Racks.
So we had TV...
Dave Ribbons.
Well, we had the ideas for a TV show, didn't we, which went down a storm. And then we decided...
Joe Cocker the Singer was my favourite.
That was the best one.
Shouts to Eddie.
And then obviously we branched out into when Saracens were finally proven to be systematically financially doping and basically cheating for all of the trophies they ever won. And came up with some business ideas. And as we mentioned, Rhinox Wine Racks, Dave Ribbons, Rave Ribbons, which was really good. And lots of others. So and they're made all the funnier when people that listen get involved and send them in. I mean, I'd love to idea for a show. Care
came up with some belters, I think, didn't
he? Eddie did. I mean, one of my favourites was Danny Care Cares, where he travelled around as a mobile carer to see. I mean, that would have worked really nicely in a pandemic. Danny Care in a face mask.
I still think that would have been better as a Esther Ranson type Saturday Night Light entertainment show,
like an agony aunt
where he gets like long lost twins to meet.
Danny Cares.
Punching Chat was a highlight as well. I really enjoyed Punching Chat.
Yeah, that was good. That, I mean, that's over a year ago that we started Punching Chat as well, which
it was such a unique idea.
Yes, never been done before.
I think it was what made it so special.
Absolutely unbelievable.
If there's one thing we are, mate, it's
original.
Same as every other podcast.
Original. I've got a little bit of a favourite from way back when we first started. I ended up at London Sevens on finals day, got absolutely shit-faced and managed to blag myself as the press and got in with the Australian Sevens team. And do you remember I did an interview?
Yes!
And brought it in and we recorded it and aired it out. God knows what it said.
I can't remember either, but I do remember you asking questions to the Sevens team on your phone, recording it on your phone, holding it underneath your chin. Yes, God, it's little things like that that you just forget, and it's like over 5 years, you know, hours and hours and hours. I mean, 5 years, we've probably done 250 odd weeks. We're probably up in the region of 200 episodes now. We got to be not far away. If only we were counting.
Well, don't make it up, Russ. Go and count them.
Well, I can't. I have to go back to SoundCloud. I probably could do that, but I'm not going to.
Aren't they all on iTunes?
No, they're not, because when I transferred over, they didn't import. So they're all just sat on SoundCloud, the back catalogue.
Well, that's
anyway. True. Yeah, all right, mate. So a couple more questions before we talk about Bristol.
The only thing I can see on your head is the reflection of your screen and your eye.
Okay, no, I need to turn a light on. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask this question, and then I'm going to let one of you answer it first. Ben Bacon. No, in fact, I'm going to ask this question by Chris Jones first. And as I say, you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But Chris Jones asks, of all the wet wipes that Maulover has fallen out with over the years, who do you want to see on the pitch in the Maulover Invitational in October? Doug, why don't you go first?
Well, I'd like to see Phil absolutely iron out Sam Lahner.
Yeah, I'd love to see that as well.
that would be incredible.
Above the chest line, so above the nipple line, where we're going to have custom
shoulder made straight to the jaw.
So I'm hoping we can find some sponsorship and get custom made shirts that have a tackle line on the chest, on the nipple. But it's
custom made hats with a tackle line across the forehead.
but it's strictly prohibited to tackle underneath the tackle line. So literally, if you tackle normally around the legs, around the waist or whatever, you are going to be penalised. It's high tackles only.
So I've been going to a bit of training down at Newquay, and second or third session, Moxie the coach goes, "Oh, it's full contact, full tackling. And I hadn't tackled anyone for probably 3 years. I haven't played a proper game of rugby. And he goes, "Anybody who does a high tackle, it's 5 bank runs." Topher gets the ball first up, runs straight at me, and I clock him on the chin with my shoulder and just run straight up to the bank. Up I go.
I mean, other than Mrs. Farm Vet, we're saying, Phil, yeah?
Yeah.
Ideal. Ben?
I'd like to see, what is it, Sam?
Peters?
Sam Peters starched as well, yeah. Tubbsy, I'd like to see you starch him from the blind side.
He used to play. I mean, all these people used to play, and we can invite them all if they haven't blocked us.
It's when they turn up and they're much better than us. That's the problem.
I don't mind them being better, mate. 100%
nailed on with me.
I just love the fact that Sam Lahner, there was a bit of back and forth on Twitter, but it was all fairly amiable. And then you invited him on the podcast and Doug just literally ripped him to shreds. We don't want to see people being hurt playing rugby. That's exactly what I want to fucking see. I want to see people get leathered.
Anyway.
Well, it's my favourite argument of, do we not care about player welfare? Absolutely don't care about player welfare. As in Roman days, just stretch them off and wheel in another one. I don't care.
There's plenty more where they came from.
Exactly.
I suppose that this is as good a time as any, Perry, to formally invite you to the Mall Over Invitational in October. Obviously, you'll be there, won't you?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
Amazing. So now we've got 5 definites. We've got people, genuinely, on Twitter, we've got people coming from all over the country. I know that JB and Tim from the Egg Chasers are keen to get involved. We've been in contact with the Hornets and the people that run the bar at the Hornets. So we're very, very hopeful that on the 9th of October, I think it's the 9th or the weekend of the 9th of October, that we will have a fixture of a description for a Mallover Invitational 15, whether that's against the touring side, whether that's against the Hornets second side or Barbarians type side or Vet side. There will be a match on that day. And you are all invited. Anybody that's there, anybody that can get to Newquay, I can sort out potentially some accommodation if needed. Bring your boots, bring your drinking hats. We're going to go old school.
Russ is going to do a barbecue.
High tackles only. There'll be a barbecue afterwards. There's going to be drinking and yards of ale. Piss pots, welly boots, any other particular vessel that you can think you might be able to drink out of that can hold liquid, you'll be drinking out of it. So if you like an old school rugby match circa 1995 in the old school rugby clubs, then this is going to be the place for you. Please don't attend if you have any concerns over player welfare. I mean, that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, there will be an obligatory bottle of port for each team at halftime.
At least.
Yeah.
So that is the Mall Over Invitational match. Let's have one more question from the listeners before we move on. And that's from one of our long-term listeners, Ben Bacon from the United States, Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. His question is, which rugby podcaster, Maulover or otherwise, would make the best dictator? Now, before you give your answer, Tim from the HAS has replied that he thinks he'd be a Stalin-esque dictator, saying everyone would everyone to be equal and fair, then slinging all the competition in a podcast gulag and making them the only one that anyone could listen to. He's got one or two podcasts in mind.
So he's got this wrong, Tim has, and this is going to wind him right up, because what's the point of a dictator? A dictator is somebody who does their own thing and does exactly what they want, which rules out most podcasters. But the good dictators bring everybody else along with them. And that's exactly what JB does. He creates his own opinion and then he convinces everybody else that it's right. So
yeah, I was going to say JB.
JB is the dictator of the egg chasers and he may as well be our dictator as well.
He's not my dictator, mate.
He's the only person I know who can come up with something that's absolutely, completely ridiculous. And then within about 30 seconds, you go, yeah, you're right. Even though it's horseshit.
Good. Good. Perry, are you in agreement?
I love seeing JB's Twitter spats and Phil's right within five threads comments. I'm like, oh, actually, yeah, he's got a fucking point. So, yeah.
He's got a certain divisive way, JB, which is so much fun to watch, because you know that when he's saying what he's saying, as much as he believes it, he knows he's going to get a reaction from people, and that's what makes it even funnier. Ben, who's your dictator from the rugby podcasting community?
Well, I was thinking about, as I do often, Saddam Hussein. And I thought, sort of been in position probably too long. Slightly, faintly sort of humorous, you know, although pure evil, there's a hint of slapstick about him. Ludicrous moustache. Finger on the button, allegedly. But the button I'm thinking of is the block button, and he could easily be Stephen Jones, couldn't he?
Yeah, like that. He would be a very sort of sit back, sort of Kim Jong Un style dictator, wouldn't he? I think.
Yeah, I think he'd be quite a ranter. He'd want everyone to agree with him, but he'd just be in charge of his sort of compound, and everyone would get on with their lives outside.
And if they didn't agree with him within the compound, he would just shoot them.
The metaphorical block would be execution.
Yeah, you know, VX gas or something like that.
So yeah, so it is a literal block, like block from society.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Doug, what about you?
Well, I might go in a slightly different direction and say Sam Lahner, because if he was in charge, there would be no alternative opinions that were acceptable. It'd be ultra left wing, like so left wing that, you know, if you earn over £12,500 a year, you literally have to give it all to poor people. So it'd be very, you know, Chinese in that regard, I guess. A very red, kind of unfair, slightly twatish regime.
Only
with,
slightly.
Weird accent.
Love it. Well, for me, there's only one man who I believe could be an effective dictator from the world of podcasting. Straight out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Eddie Stevens. Now, you know, as a stand-up comedian, he can bring people along with him. He's used to getting rooms of people on his side. I mean, I've not seen too much of his stuff online, but you know, I assume he's been relatively successful. But Eddie's got his own way of portraying his opinions. He's amazing at ranting. You know, anybody that can create a podcast where they're on their own in a shed and continue to remain sane, matter of opinion, is someone that can I think could really lead us through a really difficult time. Add to that, he's got a tremendous physique.
I was going to say he's got the guns for it, hasn't he?
He's got the guns for it, probably physically and metaphorically, being from New Mexico.
Wow.
He's got some really aggressive, allegedly not rabid dogs. And I think that, you know,
hail our Albuquerque overlord.
Absolutely. Eddie Stevens, dog cunt. There you go. He's my dictator. Anyway, that's who I would pick. And hopefully you'll hear from Eddie over the next few days. I believe he's got something special planned. Should we go back to talking a little bit about rugby? Or should we answer some more questions? Because I wanted to talk a little bit about Bristol Gloucester on Monday night. The first game, obviously live on BT Sport with fans back in the stadium. How amazing it was to listen to, you know, I've taken for granted over the last 12 months watching sport with that artificial piped in crowd noise. And when Bristol started throwing the ball about, listen to that anticipation build in the crowd was something that I never thought I'd miss. And it wasn't until I heard it, and you got to hear it a lot because Bristol had, I think, seven or eight tries disallowed. And Gloucester had one or two as well. And just that noise was spectacular. And hopefully we never have to go down to the point where there's no fans in stadiums ever again. And we can now continue to move forward. But it was quite an incredible game that Gloucester managed to find themselves still in at halftime, even though they were down to 14 men of the red card. They found themselves down to 13 at one point when Rapava Ruskin got yellow carded at the scrum. Again, like blame the prop, but you know, I'd like to see a second row go in the bin for a series of scrum penalties. Like, why does it just have to be a prop? The prop's just gone down, but the prop's being supported by the second row behind him and the flanker. It's a collective, isn't it? So why is one person being singled out? But Bristol, they just kept fucking up. They kept ballsing it up every single time.
Did you think, Russ, in this game, I didn't see it all, but I saw kind of most of the second half. And I actually thought Bristol were sort of tottering a little bit. They dropped the ball a couple of times. I think they had a try disallowed and then they just started to drop the ball. And Gloucester had a penalty on midfield, which they put into the corner. Yeah. And if they'd scored it, they'd only have been, I think, six or 4 points behind. And they just messed the line out up, which they did throughout the entirety of the second half.
Yeah.
But I actually thought if Gloucester had scored there, then Bristol might have been in a little bit of trouble. I know their fans were suffering because I thought Lloyd was going to have an aneurysm. Lloyd Collins, yeah. on WhatsApp, he was suffering. And I do wonder that, you know, they were almost starting to believe it wasn't their day, but then Gloucester didn't seize their chance.
It was always going to be Bristol's day, even from that first sort of minute or so, or that, you know, the first 5 minutes when they were really in the ascendancy. Alemano got sent off, then Rapava Ruskin got binned. They only scored the single try during that time when they were down to 13 men because they just kept making errors, but they were cutting through Gloucester at will. I mean, Piatow was literally over the line when Moyle came back and punched the ball out from behind him. They seemed to be in second or third gear and just assumed that they were going to win. And then second half, it still took them, you know, a good 10, 15 minutes of that second half to score again. But once they scored that third try, and they got a try, you know, pretty quickly afterwards. That it all just settled them down. Obviously, the likes of Ben Earl, Hughes, Radrandra were excellent. But again, Kyle Sinclair was absolutely outstanding. Malin's on the wing was quality again, but they
did he big, did Sinclair cry after the game this time?
No, because he wasn't man of the match. Okay. But what Bristol have got is they every single one of their players is comfortable on the ball. The amount of Premiership players, forwards especially, obviously, but in a lot of other teams, you don't really see them get the ball. I mean, even the likes of Harry Williams or Ben Moon or Jake Cooper Woolley and, you know, those sorts of players.
Come on, Jake, of all the props in the
Premier League, I know, yeah.
Jake Cooper Woolley.
I know, yeah. I my mind went blank for a second.
Your brain.
But I just went sort of for a standard, almost old school prop. Yeah, like. But then you watch John Afoa, you watch Kyle Sinclair, you watch those guys, and they're giving offloads out the back door. They're getting involved in build-up play. They're all so comfortable on the ball, which is what makes Bristol so dangerous because they keep the ball alive all the time.
But they haven't signed those two by accident, have they?
Are you sure we're not in danger here of becoming a little bit sort of, oh, West Ham always play good football about Bristol?
I think so.
I do as well, because it Gloucester are shit.
They are shit. And they were down to 14.
They could have scored 16 tries.
Yeah, they could.
they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Bristol give me very strong.
Sure. You can join in the circle bank, Russ. You know.
Sure. I like watching it. I like the opposite to Ben.
Come back.
I like watching free flowing running rugby with an element of physicality. So I like super rugby with tackling is what I like. So rugby, Doug, correct.
Yeah.
I don't like to see a 12-9 in the middle of December at the Rec. On a Friday night in a howling gale. Don't like it.
This isn't the podcast for you.
Yeah.
I think you'll find it is.
Harry, that hasn't changed. I'm still.
I was just going to say, is that still you? I still think of you when it's like a 3-3 game or something like that.
It's the latest social media thing, isn't it? When there's a game that's finished 75-83 or something like that. Oh, don't say you weren't entertained. No, I wasn't entertained because no cunt made a tackle for 80 minutes.
Nobody's got muddy knees.
Exactly. But yeah, sure. Bristol are great.
All right. Well, we'll leave that there then. Gloucester are. Okay, let's round off the games. Exeter last night away at London Irish. Sam Simmons has now scored 19 Premiership tries in 18 Premiership games. Is that right?
Yeah.
19 and 19. Absolutely unbelievable. 19 and 19. Unbelievable statistics. Smashed the previous record to pieces of top try scorers for a season, and there's still 3 games to go. And he said in his interview afterwards that it was down to his teammates who give him the ball in that situation. I think it was something like, what a guy. Well, you know. But he exits a play a certain way, and he's been lucky enough to be on the end of it. Dave Ewers finds himself on the end of it quite a bit as well, doesn't he? But
you can wank about it all you like, and I will. He is doing a fantastic job. And it's becomes a bit more impressive when you think about the fact that A, he's a forward, B, Luke Cowan-Dickie is usually the one at the back of the rolling balls, so he's not taking that role, which Waldron was getting a lot of his tries off the back of a rolling line out. But he's just a symptom of that team. That's all it is. The team play in the 5-metre area, a very forwards-dominated game, but then in open play, he's got speed and he's got good hands and he'll get involved, so he will score tries. But to me, it's great what he's done. It's a personal record in a team game. So let's just move on.
The most interesting thing about Simmons' performance last night, and I think it went under the radar a bit in the commentary, was that not only was did he score a hat trick and he broke the record, but he'd made the most tackles.
Him and Yanis Kirsten, wasn't it? Who is Simmons and Yanis Kirsten before?
He's some player, isn't he?
He is unbelievable. He is.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And you know when they had that break where Slade kicked the ball through, Hassel Collins got back and recovered it, and obviously the Irish back three and Slade and O'Flaherty were there competing at the breakdown, and then Kirsten came out absolutely nowhere and just marmalised everyone off the ball and won a turnover. It was like, how did that weird ginger thing get there so quickly?
he looks like a big South African farmer who's just appeared out of nowhere.
He looks like he's broken several girlfriends.
I mean, and you know, I'd Vermeulen into that as well. You know, obviously there was Dave Ewers.
He looks like he spent his teens running into cars.
Yeah,
just unbelievable.
And keeps doing it.
Yeah,
I mean those two. I think those two have got to be up there for the best South Africans in the Premiership. They just the amount of work and effort they put in is phenomenal. And it's not only that, I think there was a stat midway through the second half or midway through the first half that Irish had been dominant in something like 17% of collisions. And that's pretty much because of those two players, because they'll carry the ball in and they'll hit Vermeulen or Kirsten and they'll go back 4 yards every time. Mm. And it doesn't matter who it is. You can be the biggest player on the pitch.
Yeah.
You get marmalised again and again and again, and there's only so much of that that any player can take.
It felt like last night every other tackle was Vermeulen or Kirsten or Simmons, and it was just like those three, just like a brick wall everywhere. Wherever London Irish went, one of those guys was always there, and it was absolutely phenomenal.
I just don't understand where these South Africans keep coming from. Do you remember
South Africa.
5 years old? Where South Africa were 5 years ago in terms of international rugby. England had beaten them, seven games in a row or something like that?
Yeah, and do you remember they didn't win a game
in New Zealand?
Yeah, that's right. In the Tri-Nations as it was then, they were getting bummed in that, weren't they? It was just horrible everywhere.
I think they finally managed to meld together that kind of natural physique with a decent skill set and good access to pharmaceutical aids in their teenage years.
I think if you had to design a back row forward from scratch, you would say, find me a South African farmer and we'll go from there.
Because and then jab him with roids for 4 years before he's 19.
Do you think the way the game sort of developed over the last four or five years, that it's actually playing into that kind of player's hands, whereas you go back a few years and maybe it wasn't so much? It can't be 60 South Africans that just drop into the Premiership and they're the best. If you took 50 best players in the Premiership, I'd say 25 of them are South African.
Rugby goes in cycles, doesn't it?
They've always been big, but they didn't necessarily have the skill set to go with it and the competitiveness. And they went through this shit stage of Super Rugby where they were just getting smashed every game. And then they developed a bit from that and their international game developed a bit. And then they realised that they could come to Europe and make a wedge of money. And I think that's kind of driven the pipeline, and it's just taken a few years to get there.
You've gone from Michael Rhodes and John Smith and people like that coming over, you know, and settling here, and Moritz Botha and people like that.
Brits.
You remember JP Peterson came over and he was an absolute disaster. It's interesting that they're not other than Reinach, they're not really exporting a lot of good backs, are they? And De Klerk, I guess.
Well, you've got, Dielende in Ireland?
Yeah, I think Dielende is pretty average. I don't think he would get into a Lions squad, for example. I just think he's and he got found out in Europe, didn't he, when he played in Europe?
Do you think this is where the styles of play in the different countries are, and the leagues is almost sort of fundamentally different? Because you find a lot of the South African backs, as well as a lot of the Kiwi guys that go to France. Obviously, it's money related because they are commanding the most money, so they're going to France. With the exception of like Fekitoa and Sopawaga, who, you know, you wouldn't say they've been roaring successes in the Premiership. Whereas the forwards tend to fit in better in the Premiership than they do in France.
I think Fekitoa is fantastic for a start.
Yeah. I think
Fekitoa is great, but equally, there's some bloody good South African forwards gone to play in France as well.
Yeah. I mean, the likes of Juan Smith. Bota. Yeah, Matt Field, Juan Smith. Yeah, they all did it.
France's second rows.
Yeah, I'm just trying to rationalise it a little bit, I guess.
I wonder if it's more to do with South Africa, a little bit victim to their coaches, because they seem to either have a brilliant coach or an absolute disaster. Because if you look at the Lions, the last three times the Lions have gone to South Africa, they've played the world champions.
Yeah.
So it's not like New Zealand where they've had a long period of domination. They've really gone up and down, a sort of more cyclical thing. I remember watching, quite a few years ago now, when England went over there, and England had Thomas Waldron playing eight, and South Africa had Vermeulen, Albert and Lowe as their back row. And in one test, I don't think I've ever seen ball carrying like it. They were just hitting the 10 channel just constantly. And big players like that, once they get a downhill run, they're almost unstoppable. But it doesn't seem to be a consistent selection, doesn't seem to be consistent. You know, coaches just come in and completely ship out players. They come to Europe and stuff like that. So whether it's more to do with the money pulling them out of South Africa, I don't know.
Quite possibly. I mean, you know, there could be a multitude of reasons. But just going back to Exeter very briefly before we get into some any other business. I feel like, and I know there was the Exeter a peaking just at the right time. I think they're coming, they went through a shaky few weeks and now they're just coming back into some kind of form at the right time towards the end of the season. And, you know, the victory in Bristol a couple of weeks ago, they've scored something like 190 points in four games and they're really starting to hit their straps at the right time. And if it stays the way it is, I think we could be in line for two, you know, the Sale Exeter semi-final, if that's what it is to be, currently second versus third. Those two styles sit very well, as well as Bristol versus Harlequins. And I could see two really good semi-finals there. I worry, like, if it was to be Bristol versus Sale and Exeter Quins, for instance, I think the two better teams would shut the second and the third and fourth teams down. But we'll see. And the other thing I want to mention is Hugo Monier last night and spent the best part of 5 minutes talking about a Henry Slade near interception knock on. I don't know whether you remember this. He went, I think it was Meehan. Who was the starting nine for? Was it
Phipps.
Meehan?
Phipps and then ex-Saint Nick Groom came on.
Yes, that's right. And Phipps threw a long pass out towards Phil Thokonosigo, who I thought was excellent. And Slade went to intercept it, genuinely went to intercept it, tapped it in the air, just couldn't gather it, like knock on whatever. And then Hugo Monya spent 5 minutes saying, oh, we've seen so many yellow cards for that type of deliberate knock on. And, you know, what you could see that Slade there genuinely tried to intercept it and it's good. And we're seeing too many yellow cards and just baffling amounts of irrelevance. And he was almost arguing for Slade to get a yellow card whilst not arguing for Slade to get a yellow card. Just contradicting himself with every word that came out of his mouth. And, you know, for me, he's becoming a bit of a parody of himself as a commentator. And it's just, you know, it's frustrating me a little bit when I have to listen to him. So there you go.
Cheers for that, Russ.
Little Monya rant. Sorry about that.
I think he's great.
These are not the views of Douglas Andrews.
Talking of Hugo, I really enjoyed the Leicester Harlequins game. Thought that was a good game.
Why was he not working there?
But Nadolo obviously kind of dominated the game, but it was interesting to see Ford against Smith because I thought Ford kind of got the better of it. But you can still see how good Smith is. Like every pass he picks is the right pass.
I just think he's a bit of a magician, isn't he? In that Quinn's team, he's been allowed to run his show. From what you can visually see, it's his show, and he can run it like heads up. As you see it, play as you see it, Marcus. We trust you. Whereas I think in certain circles, like George Ford or certain other 10s, it's so structured, especially with England, that the 10 isn't allowed to run it as he sees it because he's very much hamstrung by a system or by a tactic or by whatever.
Yeah, every pass he picks is a good pass. You know, obviously, sometimes he's got two or three right options because people are picking good lines, but you know he doesn't seem to waste the ball, waste the pass, and I again just really impressed by him. Green played really well, Tyrone Green, thought he played really well for them. George Martin's a good player. I know he got a bit of stick for being picked for England, but it wasn't his fault, and he was good in that game as well.
If you can tell the difference between him and Harry Wells, you're a better man than me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, constantly through that game. Yeah.
Maybe right. That's what Jones did. Wouldn't surprise you, would it? If Eddie Jones, in his autobiography, went, yeah, I picked George Martin, I actually thought it was Harry Wells, would you be surprised?
like Luther Blissett.
Yeah, and when he picked... Luther Blissett and he was the ex-Saint guy, the centre. Luther Burrell. I just wanted to have an ex-footballer on the team, so I picked Luther Burrell. He played for Watford
in the 80s.
Amazing. Didn't he get signed for AC Milan or something because they thought he was John Barnes?
That can't be right.
I'm sure I've heard that.
I mean, I can imagine an Italian doing that
in the 80s.
John Barnes.
Yeah. It was a different time.
I bet it was called John Barnes the entire time he was there as well.
It was acceptable in the 80s.
Yeah. Right. Let's move on. Any other rugby related chat from you guys? Anything else you want to add before?
Just back to the Exeter game. I don't know if anyone picked up on it, but it was club captain Jack Yendall's 200th. Appearance last night, and I have often thought of how good a player Jack Yendall is, and obviously LCD's come through and quite rightly taken the number two shirt, but I think he's been excellent for Exeter over the last, well, since they've come into the Premiership. He's been there since they came up, was he?
Yeah, not long after they came up. He wasn't one of the originals.
Russ, do you remember when
I was just about to say that was one of my favourite moments. That was something I've forgotten about. That was at the Premiership final.
Jack.
When he came off the bench, Jack Yendall.
He sat there with people who called George Cruz, Cruis.
I mean, pronunciation is Ben's gig usually, but
Ben, who's that? That old England centre.
John Tiny Ape. Oh, how we laughed.
To answer your question though, Perry, yeah, he's been brilliant, and he is up there with among the right at the top of the list of people I'd least like to run into pissed.
do you think his ship has sailed, or do you think he could potentially be getting England A recognition?
He might get England A, maybe.
If England A have been going for the last...
Just with his fingers.
I think if England A had been going for the last 5 years, he could have captained them most of that time. I think he would have been perfect for that role.
I only say that because, you know, Jack, the youngsters like Singleton and...
he's useless.
But people that have been around that squad that haven't really done anything, like, how many hookers are there? Thacker is not played. He must be injured. I haven't seen him for ages. But if you look, you know, top with Cowan Dickey going with the Lions, they've got two tests, England, and Tom Dunn is not available. George and Cowan Dickey with the Lions, and no Tom Dunn. England are going to have to, you know, they have to go in a different direction for somebody they've not picked before, don't they? And he can't be far down the list. If Eddie Jones wants an experienced hooker that can be a leader in that team...
what a statement.
I mean, Eddie's experienced hooker. Jill, do you like an owl song? yeah, what you could do a lot worse than Mr. Eandale, non-MBE.
Do you remember you interviewed him once, Ross?
Did, yeah, at Sandy Park, yeah.
He was very good value as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. Was that when we went to watch
the Ulster game?
Ulster.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
That was where Go Well came from, wasn't it? You told all four players to go well.
Ian Whitten, go well. Jack Yeardale, go well.
Every time I see Ian Whitten, I just want to say, mate, come on. The absolute state of it. It's time to just go and sit down. Can't be fun for you anymore. You're 130.
Literally. He's like the epitome of like the grey man, isn't he? As in, like, just blends in.
Yeah.
Not spectacular. He's
played 224 times for Exeter.
Unbelievable.
Really? I've got no doubt that he'll be turning out for Exeter amateurs when he's 65.
Love it.
Wearing his red shorts. So no tackle, probably.
And not one of us would like to play against him even then.
No. It'd be like tackling a bag of hammers, wouldn't it?
I thought you were going to finish tackling a bag of ham, but that's probably more like tackling me.
bag of blancmange.
You absolute prick. Right, like let's
tackle a beanbag.
like punching a pillow. Right, let's move on to many other business. It's time to get out of here. Perry, thank you so much for joining us. 5 years further down the line. Have you got any other business, non-rugby related, anything that you want to just bring up before we wrap it up?
I received some really worrying news this morning. My Lions tickets, I'm going to see them play Japan.
Christ, I thought you were going to say Louis.
I know.
You're going to say Louise is pregnant.
No. I now only have a 25% chance of going.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they've culled it by 75% for Murrayfield. So I'll find out next Friday.
16,500 for Murrayfield, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so they were all sold out. I was fortunate enough that I got tickets. But I'm a bit, yeah, it was announced today that 75% were being culled and refunded. So, yeah, fingers a little bit worried.
Fingers crossed. Ben, anything for you?
How many downloads did you say we'd had in the last few months?
Well, I mean, since we went on to Anchor.
We don't need to make that public knowledge.
No. Okay. I like that.
Well, All I want to say is, it's become apparent that Harry arranged to get a pound per download, and that's why he's ducked out, because he's been constantly on holiday ever since. So, yeah, I think we should out him now.
There was no written contract.
What, we should call him gay as well.
Oh God, you're going to get cancelled, Phil.
Oh, good. We've done it already. Doug, any other business?
For a team that are apparently, if you listen to Twitter, desperate for any kind of intervention to stop the hateful and sincerely and properly offensive team chant, there were an awful lot of Tomahawk war cries going on last night.
In West London?
Almost seems like no one at the sports extra gives a shit.
So let it go. Fucked, innit? Phil, are you still there?
Yeah, I am. Nothing to really say other than carry on from last week's. James is still doing his sponsored ride, run, row thing throughout May. And a big thank you to everybody who's donated and been incredibly generous. Currently sits at just over £1,000 that he's raised, which is phenomenal.
Oh, that's amazing. Well done, James.
That's the PS5 sorted.
I haven't really got anything to raise, other than a little bit of mild sincerity. It is a sincere thanks to every single person that's ever listened to this podcast, including the ones we don't like, because it, as much as we have fun doing it, sometimes it's been hard work to either to get together, or sometimes it's easier to not do it. But
sometimes the hosts lose all motivation.
Sometimes, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, but knowing that we've got support of people out there that actually like to listen to us, knowing that we actually, you know, we make a difference to a certain extent in people's life, the fact that they expect to receive a podcast from us on a Tuesday morning, like, oh no, where's it, like, it's really heartwarming. And especially after the year we've just had, it's nice that, you know, it's nice that people still listen to us. So, like, really genuinely, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for getting involved. Thanks for tweeting us. Thanks for abusing us. Thanks for literally everything. We couldn't care less if you called us all dog cunts, left, right and centre. It does not matter to us.
Do we want to say thank you to all 10 of them by name?
Yeah, well, we could do that.
Well, look, we might have one extra, because a meeting in the pub pre-match yesterday, and just want to shout out Charlie Hay, who said that he was going to download and listen to us. We already follow him, apparently, so we must.
Oh, do we?
But just going to shout him out.
Cool. Well, welcome, Charlie. Hope you enjoyed that. This is about the level you can expect. It doesn't get any better than this.
I'll give him 2 weeks.
But yeah, anyway.
Two weeks, then he'll give us a shit review.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Then he'll go and listen to Egg Chasers like everyone else.
Well, and everybody should, right? Because they're the best ones at doing
Absolutely.
This.
You shouldn't be listening to stupid Andy Goode or any of those idiots. If you're going to listen to any rugby podcast that isn't this one, listen to that one.
Yeah.
Because they started off just like us.
Yeah.
There's enough space for two, us and them, and everyone else can fuck off.
You know, yep. And without getting too circle wanky, they helped us out a lot when we first started. And like you say, they're just normal people that have got to where they are through hard work and,
actually doing it every week.
And doing it every week. Staying consistent. Anyway, right, we're fucking off now. It's Champions Cup final European weekend, isn't it? So the likelihood is, you know, we may be back. We may not be back next week. We might do an Ask More Over anything. We might do a punching chat next week. Who knows?
Our team of the season.
Oh, fucking hell. Are you sure?
Just looking back for our Facebook thing.
Yeah.
Years ago, we did team of the season with a bloody video podcast. God, with graphics and everything.
We, We should have fancy 15 team of the season with at least one player from every side.
And Brad Barrett. The
good old days. And Brad Barrett.
We will do something next week. I don't know what it is, but it will be something mediocre. So, with the best will in the world and great intentions, it's been an absolute pleasure. Here's to another, 5 months, and then we'll see where we are. speak to you all next week. Go well.
We've reached rolling contract point, haven't we?
Podcast Network.